And it's Steve Tasker who has been all over the field.
Kind of unique. He was kind of a dual role player for you.
Steve.
A balloon.
Steve. A blimp. We're not even in the stratosphere of normalcy. All right, let's get it rolling here on a Friday. Chris Brown here with you, flying solo today. Steve Tasker is out. And the guys in the control room were just joking right before the show. Hey, we should have had a cardboard cutout of Steve. That would have been great. I actually would have subscribed to that idea. I thought it would have been hilarious. Although he wouldn't have helped me all that much in terms of some back and forth communication on the show today. So it's me with you from 1 to 3. And as we know, every Friday we have the OBL Fan Friday mailbag. So if you have any questions about the team or the league at large, feel free to fire them off either at One Bills Live on Twitter, or you can hit me up on the phones at 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550. Be happy to answer any and all questions that you may have. And we have Bills roster transactions to speak of today, chief among them being the signing of free agent veteran wide receiver Tavon Austin being added to the roster, a receiver and a return man, as most of you know that follow the league. Former first-round pick back in 2013. In fact, he was the selection that the Rams wanted to make back in 2013. They actually traded up in the draft in a deal with the Bills. The Bills had the eighth pick in the draft that year. The St. Louis Rams, St. Louis at the time, moved up from pick 16 to 8 to take Tavon Austin and add him to their offense and their special teams unit. The Bills obviously slid back 8 spots and then drafted quarterback E.J. Manuel that year. So a little bit of irony in that Tavon Austin is now here in Buffalo. And a short time after making the signing official, maybe a couple hours after, they released undrafted rookie wide receiver Malik Williams. So they're back down to 11 players at the wide receiver position, 88 players on the roster, so still two open roster spots there. And I know the first thing that people want to know is, ooh, what does this signing mean? It's a veteran player. Maybe it's a name that you've recognized and heard of before. I'm just going to say this. Last year, Austin in Jacksonville, 13 games, 24 catches, 213 yards and a touchdown. Some pedestrian production, had trouble getting on the field there in what I think some might describe at least as a decent receiving core there in Jacksonville. And with Urban Meyer running the show, who knows what the circumstances were down there. But he had trouble getting on the field his last few years. Green Bay in 2021 had trouble getting on the field there in 2020. And in Dallas in 2018 and 2019 had trouble getting on the field there. In fact, his 24 catches that he had last season were the most that he's had in any season since 2016, when he was last a full-time starter. So you might say, well, what's the attraction for the Bills with this signing? Clearly, they believe he's still got something to offer in terms of competition at the position on this roster. Size and skill set-wise, he's most similar to Isaiah McKenzie. He's 5'8", 179 pounds. As I mentioned, he also has return experience. So in my eyes, this signing is one of three things. Could be a signing that serves notice to others at the position that they better step it up, particularly on the back half of the receiver depth chart. And this is a practice that we know the Bills have had in place since Sean McDermott came in as head coach. There is a constant roster churn on the bottom eighth of the roster. Even now, with one of the best rosters in the league, the Bills feel if they can bring in competition that's going to raise the level of play and maybe push players to be the best version of themselves on the back end of the roster, whether it's the guy they're adding or the guys who will need to go harder because of this new guy on the scene, they're going to bring that guy in. Okay, so that's part one of this. So that could be the main reason they're bringing in Austin at this stage of the game. The other reason I find far more interesting, and I want to emphasize, this is just a hypothesis on my part. I think the other possible reason for the Austin addition is because of what the team might feel it needs in the return game. Steve and I have talked about this, how Isaiah McKenzie, in every opportunity that he has had to start, you know, he's been a spot starter here and there the last couple of seasons. And in every opportunity he has had to start, he has proven himself capable of making a significant impact in the passing game. So whether it was McKenzie's 3-touchdown game against the Dolphins in the season finale of the 2020 season, where 2 of those touchdowns came on offense, obviously he had an 84-yard return for a touchdown as well, or, and he had six catches for 65 yards, a couple of touchdowns in that game against the Dolphins. That was that blowout 56-26 game. Or whether it was last year against the New England Patriots in Week 15, where he had to spell Cole Beasley and play the slot full time and goes 11 catches for 125 yards and a touchdown. And I think the most instrumental part of his performance was his ability to extend drives. I think 4 or 5 of his catches came on 3rd down in that game to extend drives, keep drives alive. So it begs the question, with Tavon Austin coming in, is the offensive staff ready to give McKenzie more time on offense? And if so, is it going to be extensive enough where they may need to turn to someone else as the primary return man? Most would say, in that case, the heir apparent to the return game would be Marquez Stevenson, who got his first start in New Orleans on Thanksgiving, you might remember, as a returner last year as a rookie. But again, we come back to the priority the Bills place on having legitimate competition at every position. So Austin could be chief competition for Speedy Stevenson at the return position, perhaps. We'll have to see how it all unfolds. But finally, the third part of this signing, and the way I look at how this deals with the receiver position as a whole, okay, on this current roster that is widely believed to be a Super Bowl contender in every way, shape, and form, prior to the signing of Tavon Austin today, of the 11 receivers on the roster before Austin was signed, only 4 of the 11 are proven NFL receivers. Now, that's not to say the younger players on this roster are not capable. Many of them have just flat out not had the opportunity. I mean, Isaiah Hodgins, I think he's dressed for 1 game in his NFL career. Otherwise, he's largely been on the practice squad. But the point here is that's less than half of your receiving core where you know definitively what you have in that player. With Austin, at least you know what you have in him as a player, and he makes it 5 of the 11 on the roster right now that are quote-unquote proven receivers at this level. So we'll have to see where it goes, and maybe we get a better glimpse as to what it could mean when we go out to OTAs next week, and maybe we get a little bit of a clue as to, you know, Austin getting up to speed. How much time he'll get on the field remains to be seen, but it'll be interesting to see how he factors in and where this goes going forward. But I think he's a competition piece primarily. And then, you know, if he performs and does well and can carve out a niche for himself on this roster, well, more power to him. But I think that's yet to be seen. So we'll just have to let it all play out and take it from there. But those are my thoughts on it anyway. If you have any thoughts on it, feel free to chime in at 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550. Wanted to mention this before we got too far into the show, but today is National Gun Violence Awareness Day. And a lot of professional teams, including the Bills, are making sure we pay attention to that. And the Bills actually put out a statement earlier, and in essence, they basically said as follows: June 3rd is National Gun Violence Awareness Day. Let's first take time to mourn all those who have lost their lives to gun violence. And then let's all commit to providing a safer community. Innocent children and adults are losing their lives, as we saw here in Buffalo and across our country. We can no longer be spectators. Enough is enough. Together, we all can make a difference. Stop hate and racism and gun violence. Choose love. We continue to work with the community leaders in East Buffalo and across our region to better understand how to help and to act on solutions. This is both our short-term and long-term pledge. We encourage you to learn, donate, or support the following efforts at ending gun violence and helping our community. There is a link that you can go to on the BuffaloBills.com site. It's BuffaloBills.com/community/help-Buffalo. So if you want to help our local community here, that's where you can go. You can just go to the homepage, BuffaloBills.com. Pull up the statement that I just read. There's a link at the bottom to go to there if you want to get involved. And the color that people are wearing all weekend for the National Gun Violence Awareness Day is Wear Orange Weekend. Everybody's wearing orange. You can also go to wearorange.org. And if you don't live in Buffalo or in the Western New York area, you can find an event this weekend to go out and demonstrate your support or find a way to participate. And there are other professional teams, as I mentioned, that are addressing this in a big way. As a matter of fact, I saw that the Denver Broncos released a statement. They said, we wear orange every day, but today on National Gun Violence Awareness Day, we wear orange in honor of all the lives lost and impacted by senseless gun violence. And they have a link as well. I saw that Philadelphia Eagles owner Jeffrey Lurie was very direct in his statement that he released. And I'll try to pull that up as soon as I can find it again. I just lost it on my computer here. But, here it is. So he had a long and lengthy statement. But to sum it up, he is urging the country to act and call on lawmakers to enact tangible change, including banning assault weapons and instituting mandatory universal background checks, which all runs parallel to the message by President Biden last night in a speech he gave to the nation, which basically he was saying, too, enough is enough. And so Wear Orange Weekend in recognition of, you know, what we're dealing with here, which is National Gun Violence Awareness Day. So hopefully you can check that out. If you're interested in participating, you can click on one of those links and find a way to do so. Other NFL news and notes, and there are some, including one dealing with COVID surveillance. So for the better part of the last 2 years, the NFL, along with every other professional league for that matter, has had a long list of COVID protocols that players, coaches, staff members have had to abide by, and with good reason. Well, the NFL Management Council informed clubs last night that COVID surveillance testing of players and staff is no longer required, regardless of an individual's vaccination status. Another step of going back to the normal way of doing business in the NFL, because as you remember, back in March, the protocols that the NFL and the NFL Players Association had agreed upon were suspended. Now it looks like, at least for now, they're going away on a permanent basis. Now, it did say in the memo that COVID testing still should occur, quote, when clinically indicated and or at the direction of the club physician. And any individual experiencing symptoms must promptly report them and receive a negative test before entering a club facility. I guess the point here is it looks like we are finally drifting back towards the normal way that the NFL has always done business on a daily basis in each of their respective 32 NFL team facilities. So that is certainly good news going forward. Found this interesting. AFC East News, a report out of New York, has not been positive for quarterback Zach Wilson at OTAs for the Jets. Pro Football Network reporter Mike Kay was not very complimentary of Wilson's performance at the last OTA practice that was open to the media. Apparently he was on hand. And he said, this is his assessment of Zach Wilson's day at Jets OTAs, said Wilson got off to a rough start in team drills. His first four passes were as follows. A throw behind wide receiver Corey Davis, a throw that hovered over everyone, a clear throwaway after being flushed out of the pocket, and another bad misfire. He did say that Wilson did have a few nice throws over the middle to Elijah Moore, who's projecting to be their starting slot receiver going forward, their former second-round pick from last year. But here's the thing. Wilson's completion percentage last year was 55.6%. I mean, Josh Allen in his rookie year was 58%. Wilson, 55.6. No quarterback in the league had a worse completion rate over expected. Only Justin Fields had a worse adjusted completion rate. And that's according to Pro Football Focus. That's where I'm getting those numbers from. Wilson, I think we all know, is going to be under the gun to show some marked improvement, especially with all that the front office has done to support the second-year Jets quarterback with a revamped offensive line, more weapons in the passing game, and another top running back prospect in Breece Hall. So if it doesn't materialize this year, and I'm not saying he's got to be lighting it up in week one or week two, but you get to week 8, 9, or 10, and there is not noticeable progress and an increased efficiency in play from Zach Wilson, not only will the boo birds be out at MetLife Stadium, the New York media is going to be all over this kid. And for a kid that has never lived in a city bigger than Draper, Utah, before coming to New York / New Jersey, I'm very curious how he's going to handle that if, in fact, that's what comes to pass. I expect that he'll be better because he has a better team around him, second year in the system, all of that stuff. But there has to be noticeable improvement there where he's got a support system that, yes, is making plays, so it's not all on him, but he's going to have to make a handful of plays a week if that Jets fan base is truly going to get behind him and actually believe he can be the franchise quarterback for them. So that's something else that bears watching through the course of the offseason here in the summer. How does minicamp go for Zach Wilson? And then, most importantly, training camp in the preseason leading into his second NFL campaign with the Jets. So something to keep an eye on for sure. As we told you yesterday, Ryan Fitzpatrick is going to retire after 17 seasons in the NFL. NFL.com has already put together a top 9 list of his 9 NFL stops, and the Bills and his time here in Buffalo ranked number 2 on the list. Number 1 was his stop with the Jets, which, you know, I'm kind of like, okay, maybe I see where you're coming from. I'd argue that Buffalo should be number 1 on the list, not because I'm biased, but for a couple of reasons here. First, he was a starter here for 3.5 seasons. That's longer than anywhere else, any other team he played for in his career. He was only the Jets starter for 2 seasons. My guess as to why he ranked first on the NFL.com list, why New York ranked first on the NFL.com list in his top 9 stops, is because his one-loss record with the Jets was 13-14, which was better than his starting record with the Bills, which was 20-35. He didn't make the playoffs anywhere, which is probably the biggest disappointment, not only for Fitz, but if you're a fan of Fitz, you kind of feel bad. You know, 17 seasons in the league, never got to participate in the playoffs or the postseason, and came awfully close a couple of times, including with the Jets in 2015. All he had to do in week 17 was come up here and win a football game, and they could not do it. I think he threw 2 interceptions in that game. I remember one to Manny Lawson distinctly, and they lost here, and because of that, they got bounced from playoff contention, as I think they finished, I want to say it was 10-6 or 9-7, and they missed out on the playoffs as a wild card. Now, his most productive season in the NFL was also with the Jets in that 2015 season that I mentioned, when he threw for almost 4,000 yards, 31 touchdowns and 15 picks. That was his best touchdown-to-interception ratio season of his career as well. And as we all know, Fitz did throw a fair amount of picks in his career. So I guess I could understand why the Jets ranked number 1 in terms of his stops across the league, had his best one-loss record there. But even Fitz has said his time in Buffalo with the Bills was the ones that he appreciated the most. And if you need any convincing, just cue up the film of him at the Bills playoff game last year here in Buffalo in frigid conditions, shirtless with gloves on, screaming like a crazy fan. So maybe he'll come back for more games. Let's wait and see. We saw that there was another turn in the Deshaun Watson civil suit situation. We told you yesterday on the show, 23rd civil suit filed against Deshaun Watson. The accuser there was impacted by the HBO Real Sports report on the 22 other civil suits, and this plaintiff felt compelled to file a civil suit in the wake of that as well, based on the alleged crimes committed against her. So, in that latest civil suit that was filed, it's been reported that it was revealed within the contents of that civil suit that Watson allegedly offered that plaintiff $100,000, as well as the other 22 accusers, to settle each of the cases last year. And that didn't happen, as we know, since all of those civil suits are still pending. So we've seen Deshaun Watson and his attorney vehemently denying any and all charges. And then it comes out here that he allegedly offered $100,000 to each of his accusers in an effort to settle all of those cases. That obviously did not happen. So make of it what you will, but that's where they are on that case. And I'm sure this isn't the last twist and turn we're going to see in the Deshaun Watson situation. We have to take a break here because when we come back, going to be joined by Ravens beat reporter for Ravens.com, Clifton Brown, going to join us as we start to tick down the list of upcoming Bills opponents this fall. It's Bills Ravens in week 4 for Buffalo this season. We'll catch up with Clifton Brown to get the latest on the Ravens next here on One Bills Live, presented by Kalata Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, welcome back to One Bills Live. Chris Brown here with you on a Friday, and pleased to be joined now as we kind of run down the list of opponents on Buffalo's 2022 schedule this coming fall. Bills are going to be visiting the Ravens in week 4, and here to kind of help me dice up what's going down in Baltimore here in the offseason with OTAs in full swing is the guy that kind of covers things for the Ravens team website. It is Cliff Brown joining me on the show. And Cliff, first of all, how you doing? You enjoying your so-called off season here?
Yes, there is no such thing, but yeah, it's been busy. So there's been a lot to write about. So yeah, I am enjoying the fact that there's been a lot going on and there's a lot to look forward to next season.
Yeah. And I guess I would be foolish if I didn't start with Lamar. I know him not being there kind of caught a lot of attention, as it naturally would, because he's usually been at all of these voluntary practices over the years, as I understand it, for the most part, but not there now. We've got the contract situation. Otherwise, he's playing on the fifth-year option. We know that it's a little bit of a different situation because he and his mom represent him. He doesn't have a true agent, shall we say. So where do we sit now? Because I thought that Coach Harbaugh's comments last week were, I don't know, they were kind of cryptic in a bit of a way, saying he was going to let Lamar speak for himself. Where do you think it all sits? I don't think it's acrimonious, right?
No, I mean, Lamar has given every indication that he wants to be with the Ravens long term. So I don't think that's where things are at all. Again, I don't think that Coach Harbaugh or anyone wants to speak for Lamar as to why he has not been at OTAs. I think, sure, the Ravens would love to have him there, but he has been working with his personal coach all throughout the offseason. At some point, you know, when he comes back, he'll have to answer as to why he wasn't here for the first 2 weeks of OTAs. But I think, you know, Lamar, his focus has always been on trying to help the Ravens win a championship. I don't think that's changed. The contract, sure, it's a big deal. It's you see the money the quarterbacks are making. So, sure, until he signs a contract, that narrative is going to continue. But I think once Lamar comes back and starts playing football, that's not going to be a distraction for him or the Ravens. As long as that's the case, everything's fine.
The other thing I was hoping you could do for us is provide a little context, because, you know, you see comments on Twitter and it's just little snippets and bites here. And I saw that offensive coordinator Greg Roman, I guess he was asked a question about Lamar playing catch up because he's not at OTAs. And Coach Roman basically said, oh, he's going to have some new things to learn. And so that sparks interest and speculation as to, you know, what kind of tweaks and changes there are going to be in the scope of the offense. Can you just provide some context to what Coach Roman was getting at exactly there?
Yeah, well, obviously the Ravens are not going to run the exact same offense they did last season. No team is. So whatever changes they're putting in, when Lamar does come, he's going to have to catch up with the guys who have already been here. That being said, it's June. It's not September. He's got plenty of time to do that. I don't think it's going to be an issue moving forward that Lamar is going to run out of time to get up to speed on the offense. So, yeah, that's what he was alluding to. I think he was an honest answer that, yes, they are working on some things now that they didn't do last year. And that all players, even not just Lamar, all the vets who haven't been here, once they do come, they're going to have to catch up. But that's not unusual. That happens every year.
Yeah.
And for Lamar, I don't think it's going to be a major problem.
We know that, you know, tight end Mark Andrews is the top target, has been. But what do we make of the receiver pecking order? Is there, you know, a true number one guy that they expect to ascend into like a true number one receiver type role? I mean, is Bateman going to be that guy? Is it somebody else? How do you kind of see things shaking out with the receiver pecking order, excluding Andrews?
I think Rashad Bateman is certainly the guy you would point to as the number one successor to Marquise Brown's, the number one receiver. He's a first-round draft pick. Mm-hmm. He played well once he got on the field last year. He must have missed the first five games with injury. So for a guy who wasn't able to participate in a lot of training camp, none of the preseason, and again had to play catch-up, I thought Bateman did well. So this is an opportunity for him, Devin Duvernay, James Prochet, Tylan Wallace, all wide receivers they've drafted in the last two or three years, to step forward and claim that spot. There'll also be other wide receivers vying to try and make the team. And it wouldn't shock me if the Ravens went out and signed a veteran wide receiver at some point before week one. But they've invested a lot in draft picks at wide receiver over the last two or three years. And now it's time for Bateman and Duvernay and Prochet and others to seize this opportunity. So that's going to be something to watch in training camp, how well they're playing as a group. And as you mentioned, the space for to be the Ravens' number one wide receiver target, it's wide open because that guy was Marquise Brown and he's no longer here.
Yeah, and I don't know if this necessarily flies in the face as to what the Ravens have been over the years, but very often we see they usually have a healthy contingent of veteran players that get a lot of snaps on both sides of the ball. And as you pointed out, there really isn't one at the receiver position right now. So if what you said could happen does happen come, you know, late July, mid-August, a veteran receiver comes in, do we take that as a sign that some of these younger receivers just have the coaching staff a little bit nervous that maybe they're not quite ready yet?
Well, you could look at it that way, and it remains to be seen what happens. Sometimes that could be the case. It could also just be that there's a veteran out there who they feel, to use an old Ozzie Newsome cliche, right player, right price. If they feel there's an opportunity to get someone who can help them at any position, they're never hesitant to add that player on board. I do think that overall, when you look at the Ravens wide receivers, that I think the Ravens are in a lot of ways getting back to maybe what they were in 2019 when they were 14-2, that they had the best running attack in football. They had a really good offensive line. Of course, Lamar's the best running quarterback in football. And they threw the ball, but not as much as a lot of teams in the NFL do. I think that the Ravens want to get back to that. It's not that they don't want to throw the ball at all, and they certainly want to be able to produce some big plays in the passing game. But They do have an all-pro tight end in Mark Andrews. So they have a prolific tight end. They drafted two tight ends, which has always been a big part of our offense. So he's going to be a main cog, Andrews, in the passing game. You know, if their wide receivers, if they have a couple of guys who, you know, get 600-700 yards and they go 14-2, they'll live with that. Oh, so yeah. I think for the Ravens, the way they want to play, maybe there won't be as much pressure on these young wide receivers to step in and be a 1,000-yard guy like Marquise Brown was last year, if they're able to get back to running the football the way they did a few years ago.
I know there were a lot of people that were super high on David Ajabo prior to his tragic Achilles injury at his pro day. Is he pretty much with a stamp 2023? Like, they're not even thinking about 2022 for him. What's the latest on him?
No, on the contrary, the Ravens seem to be pretty confident that he's going to play at some point this season.
Wow.
Now, when that's going to be, you know, it's too early to say that. I will tell you, he was at OTAs Wednesday on the sideline, you know, looking, he was in street clothes, but he's doesn't look like a guy who was hurt, you know, 4 months ago, put it like that, or whenever. That's a couple of months ago. Yeah, this pro day is March. So, yeah, I mean, it's great to be young and athletic. He looks like a guy who, you know, might be able to recover quicker than was initially expected. So, no, they're not looking at him as being a guy who won't help them this season. They're looking at him as being a guy at some point who's going to be part of their defense. And as it gets closer to the fall, when that point will be, will become more clear.
So we're probably looking at him as like a reserve PUP type, you know, miss the first six games at the least, and then they'll kind of weigh things out from there, or maybe even further down the line.
Yeah, I mean, I think that could happen. But they've had experiences like this before. You know, in Terrell Suggs' career, he tore his Achilles.
Right.
Similar time frame. Of course, you know, devastating news when it happened. People thought maybe he wouldn't play the next season, and he came back that year and, you know, really was playing well down the stretch. So, again, it's speculation. It's too early to say. But, yeah, all I'm saying is it would be inaccurate to say that he's been ruled out for 2023. And they have – I don't think they're just being unrealistically optimistic. They feel that because of the progress that he's made so far, that there's definitely a point in time this year where he could play and help them.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, it was a short time ago. Achilles was like a one-year death sentence for sure, and that just doesn't seem to be the case anymore. It's amazing. Five of the Ravens' first seven picks on defense, including three DBs. How many of those rookie players may get on the field at some point in time, do you think?
Well, we can start with Kyle Hamilton, their first round pick, number 14 overall, the safety. I think he's going to be a huge part of that defense. You know, guys can play center field, close to the line of scrimmage, in the box, extremely athletic for a 6'4" safety. You don't see safeties that tall.
Right.
I think he's going to be a huge part of their defense as a rookie. Travis Jones, defensive tackle in the third round, I think he's going to be in the defensive line rotation. The Ravens wanted to bring or get younger up front. They did re-sign Calais Campbell, but Derek Wolfe didn't play at all last year. And so his status for next season is uncertain. Brandon Williams has not been re-signed. So, yeah, I think Travis Jones has a real good chance to be part of defensive line rotation. And then Jalen Armour-Davis, actually two corners, Jalen Armour-Davis, he was a fourth-round pick. I think he has a good chance to be part of the corner rotation. Marcus Peters and Marlon Humphrey, their top two corners, they were both injured last year.
Right.
They expect them back, but they lost some depth in corner. They did not re-sign Anthony Averett. They didn't re-sign Tavon Young. Jimmy Smith hasn't been re-signed. So Jalen Armour-Davis could step in, certainly as a corner. And then Damarrion Williams, a corner from Houston, he played everywhere in the secondary at Houston. He played slot. He played outside. He even played safety. So he's got a lot of potential to be a backup corner. So, yeah, the Ravens had 11 picks in the draft. A lot of people, including myself, didn't really think they would draft 11 players, but they did. So they're looking for a lot of these guys to step in. And if they're not starters, certainly be guys who contribute on Sundays, but certainly Kyle Hamilton, I think he could be one of the top defensive rookies, you know, in the league this year if he's as good as people think he's going to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's a youth movement for sure. Like, the likes of which we haven't really seen in Baltimore in quite some time, at least in terms of volume. But you mentioned Kyle Hamilton, and I'm scratching my head a little bit, Cliff, because Chuck Clark's a pretty damn good safety, and they just signed Marcus Williams to a 5-year, $70 million contract. So is Kyle Hamilton like a big nickel? Like, where is he going to factor in?
Well, that's a good question. I think that, you know, there's a lot of potential for the Ravens to play three safeties a lot.
Okay.
Chuck Clark has been at OTAs. He's been a big help to Marcus Williams as far as getting him up to speed in the defense. And, you know, I think some people are assuming that, you know, adding Williams and Hamilton means that Chuck Clark isn't going to be a big part of the defense. But he's one of the Ravens' defensive leaders. No one knows their defense better. And I think that, you know, in today's NFL where teams are throwing the ball so much and you've got to match up with athletic players, that the Ravens have three safeties now who are really good and able to play a lot of different positions on the field. So, yeah, I think that they will be a team that, even though I don't think they thought that Hamilton was going to be available at 14, when he was, they thought, A, he was too good of a player to pass up, and B, their new defensive coordinator, Mike McDonald, at Michigan, did a lot of mixing and matching and really looking just to get the best 11 players on the field. We saw Aiden Hutchinson take off under McDonald last year. Dax Hill, one of their safeties, really took off. And, yeah, so obviously he's a guy that likes using athletic players. Hamilton, Williams, Clark, I think they could be on the field a lot in three safety packages.
Yeah, I mean, Hamilton's stature, it seems to make him tailor-made to cover these tall, rangy tight ends that we see all over the league nowadays. With that length, I mean, it's almost perfect to cover the bigger tight ends running around making catches all over the place in the league nowadays. Injuries, obviously, were probably the biggest reason that the Ravens' season went south and they just missed the playoffs. Of all of the guys that have had to kind of rehab from the injuries, is there anybody in that group, and I realize I'm forcing you to Rolodex a pretty big group here, Cliff, is there anybody that is still dealing with some lingering issues from those injuries from last year that's being like paced through OTAs or held back a bit even now?
Well, I'm sure there are. I mean, Ronnie Stanley, their all-pro left tackle, he has not been at OTAs. Tyus Bowser, their outside linebacker, who led them in sacks last year, he tore his Achilles the final game of last season. They had insult to injury, so he hasn't been at OTAs. Those are two guys right there. Gus Edwards hasn't been at OTAs, nor has J.K. Dobbins. They lost a top two running back. Now, Dobbins was watching from the sidelines at OTAs this week. So they have numerous players at numerous positions. Marcus Peters, he was watching from the sidelines as well, their corner. So, I mean, yeah, I think that, you know, everyone knows how many injuries the Ravens had last year. But when you really stop and think about it, when you're around a team, I mean, it was really unprecedented, the injuries they had. They lost their top two running backs. Uh-huh. They lost Peters and Humphrey, their top two corners. They lost their all-pro left tackle. I mean, that's just for starters. They suffered injuries that would have crippled any team. I mean, you think about the Bengals, the year they had getting to the Super Bowl. You know, Lamar Jackson didn't play the last five games. If you took Joe Burrow away for the last five games, if you took Joe Mixon for the entire season, if you took their starting left tackle away for all but one game, I don't think the Bengals would have made the Super Bowl. So the Ravens had so many injuries last year that it was impossible, in my opinion, for them to go farther than they did. And they start off the year 8-3. It wasn't until Lamar got hurt that the wheels really fell off and they lost their last six games. Yeah. So you would think that the odds are they'll have a much better year injury-wise this year, or certainly won't have as bad of a year injury-wise this year as they did last year. But different players are going to be coming back at different times. And right now, you know, it's too early to see, to tell who's going to be ready week one or not. But I would say, you know, Nick Boyle, their tight end, he was on the field at OTAs. He looks like a guy who has a good chance to be ready week one. And they're just hoping that Stanley, Marcus Peters, and some other guys will also be ready week one. We'll just have to see how it plays out.
And the last one I've got for you, Cliff, just to dovetail off this whole injury discussion, has Coach Harbaugh or anybody in the organization been asked by the media if they took a deeper dive into why they were so victimized with injuries to this degree? Because I got to believe this, when it happens to this degree, it's going to prompt a study on the part of the team in some way, shape, or form. And if so, what were the results of that, if they provided any?
Yeah, no question they did. That's a good question. And yeah, they spent a lot of time this offseason before OTAs looking at what they did and what changes they need to make. They haven't really talked about a lot of specific changes that they've made, but, you know, players have mentioned, you know, they're spending a lot more time stretching before practices. You know, some of the drills have been changed. There's just a lot more attention being paid to maintenance, stretching, rest and recovery. They're doing whatever they can to try and make sure that it doesn't repeat. I mean, some of it is bad luck, but as Coach Harbaugh said, when you have that many injuries, you can't just chalk it up to bad luck without taking a hard look at what you're doing. So they've done that. They're just hoping that as the season gets into training camp and the regular season, that they won't have the same amount of injuries as they did last year. And they've had a lot of healthy years in recent years. Last year just seemed to be one of those years where no matter what, they couldn't avoid it. I mean, Marcus Peters and Gus Edwards suffered season-ending knee injuries within like 20 minutes of each other at the same practice. And it wasn't even a padded practice. So, I mean, when stuff like that starts happening, you just kind of feel snake bit. But they are taking more precautions, and hopefully they'll get the results of having fewer injuries. We'll just have to see what happens.
Good enough. Well, Cliff, we'll catch up with you in the fall. Week four, man. We'll be down there your way for that game between the Bills and the Ravens in late September or early October. I can't even remember the calendar date. I just know week four. I go by the weeks. But thanks for the time, there, Cliff. We appreciate you bringing us up to speed on the Ravens.
Thanks, man. We enjoyed it. You take care.
All right. That's Ravens beat writer for BaltimoreRavens.com, Cliff Brown, joining us, kind of breaking down the Ravens for us. And I am not surprised in the least that Coach Harbaugh took a deep dive as to what the heck was going on with their injury problems last year. I mean, every other week it seemed another starter was going down. You just heard Cliff mention that they had two starting corners go down to season-ending injuries in the span of about 20 minutes of practice. And if I remember right, both of those injuries were non-contact. You heard Cliff say they weren't padded practices. I think they were non-contact injuries. Very similar to the injury we saw Tre'Davious White suffer on Thanksgiving against the Saints, which was, for all intents and purposes, a non-contact injury when his foot got caught in the turf and he tore his ACL. And October 2nd is the date of that game down in Baltimore. Healthy contingent of Bills fans down Baltimore way, as we've seen over the years, traveling down there. So hopefully that continues, because that is going to be a rock'em sock'em game for sure. We have to take a break here, but when we come back, it's our latest installment of another reason to hate Tom Brady. I'll be happy to bring it to you next here on One Bills Live, presented by Collider Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, so the latest edition of another reason to hate Tom Brady. Now, I missed this. So I watched, I would say, probably close to half of the telecast on the match. You know, the golf thing earlier this week with Rodgers and Brady and Josh Allen and Patrick Mahomes. I missed the preamble. There was like this whole pregame show, and I guess it was pretty lousy by most accounts, because number one, Aaron Rodgers was being Aaron Rodgers, which is basically disinterested in anything that he's not directly involved in terms of its idea concept. So he was basically not answering any questions. And then Josh and Patrick were trying to be cordial in some small way. There was a little bit of trash talking, but then Tom Brady decided he was going to take it to another level. While, you know, Josh kind of honed in a little bit on Brady's age and that kind of thing, Tom went into a personal attack by criticizing Josh's weight, which I guess in the first place, I'll just say, is pretty flimsy for an avenue to go down. That's number one. But I didn't see any of this back and forth commentary. J.J. Watt, I guess, was hosting this portion of it. There was like a press conference, so to speak, and J.J. Watt was moderating it. And by all accounts, it was awful. But there were some comments by Brady. I'm like, what the hell, man? Like, I understand, you know, you're ribbing each other, this and that. So there was a question where J.J. Watt asked each of the quarterbacks their greatest fear. And Brady decides he's going to chime in and answer for Allen. And he said Josh's biggest fear is vegetables. And then there was a question about favorite pizza toppings. And Josh says pepperoni, mushroom, artichoke, crushed peppers, jalapenos. Brady pounces on Josh's answer and says, looks like it, Josh. So that was two. Then comes the third one, and J.J. Watt, already seeing where Tom Brady was going, interrupted before Tom could answer because there was a question about whether guys preferred French toast or pancakes, and Watt steps in and said, Tom's going to say both for you, Josh. And then he said, I don't think he's that fat, Tom. But I'm like, holy crap, J.J. Watt, what the hell is that? Like, you don't think he's that fat? Like, where is, what the hell? So then Brady didn't miss a beat, even though J.J. steps in preemptively to answer. Brady follows up and says, with whipped cream. And then there was a question about which quarterback had the best fashion sense. And Brady said, Josh can't even get shorts that fit him. He goes to big and tall for all his shopping needs. And he even said something out on the course about one of his golf shots, calling it a little chunky. And he said, oh, I called it a little Josh Allen-y. Ho, ho, ho. You know, get a new angle there. I mean, you overplayed it. It doesn't even make sense as far as I'm concerned. And here's the other thing. Josh Allen is bigger, stronger, and faster than you, and throws a ball further. So physical attributes are the last thing that I would be criticizing Josh Allen on if I were Tom Brady. Even Tom Brady of 7 Super Bowl rings. So spare me with that one. You could have come up with a lot better stuff than what you did. And it's kind of pathetic. But in a small way, I am actually going to thank Tom Brady for going that route on Josh. Because I know, I know that Josh is going to be using that as 100% gas for the fire. So keep it coming, Tom, because you don't know what kind of fire you're playing with right now. So yet another reason to hate Tom Brady. Sure, I'm sure he's going to say it was all in good fun and he knew Josh could take it, so that's why he dished it out. You know, and Josh, you know, he took it all in stride, but I'm hoping somewhere it only adds to the size of the chip on Josh's shoulder heading into the 2022 season. So another reason to hate Tom Brady. The list is pretty long, right? What is it, like as long as my arm at this point? Another reason. Got to love it. All right, we got to take a break here. When we come back, we are going to be joined in hour number two by the one and only Connor Orr, who has just put together his 100 bold predictions for the 2022 NFL offseason. I think we can safely, or NFL season, I think we can safely call Connor an overachiever. We'll catch up with him next here on One Bills Live, presented by Kalata Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. We'll be right back.
And it's Steve Tasker who has been all over the field.
Kind of unique. He was kind of a dual role player for you.
Steve.
A balloon.
Steve. A blimp. We're not even in the stratosphere of normalcy. All right, here we are. Hour number two on a Friday. Chris Brown here with you flying solo. But pleased to be joined now by NFL writer for Sports Illustrated, Connor Orr, who I have already stamped overachiever. I mean, doing this in the offseason, 100 bold predictions for the 2022 NFL season. I'm either mad at your editor or you just have an illness. So putting together 100 of these, Connor, first of all, how you doing? You doing all right?
I'm doing well, thanks. And I think it's a little bit of both, crazy editor, crazy person.
Okay, fair enough. So it's 50-50 on the responsibility there. I'm going to start off with the highlights, at least as far as our Bills listeners are concerned. You predicted the Bills winning the Super Bowl over the Packers, which is interesting, not only because of the matchup, but because they are going to play on Sunday night, October 20th, I think it is.
Yeah, I love that matchup. I just think the Bills have rounded into the most complete team in the NFL. I think the draft really solidified it for me. And, you know, I went back to a little bit of what Ken Dorsey was able to do in Carolina. I think some of those principles will really carry over. Brian Daboll, from a strategic standpoint, is a tough loss, but I think that he complements Josh Allen, the player, well. I don't think that offense is really going to skip a beat very much. And they're just, to me, the most complete team of football. I think they're going to not walk through that AFC. It's a tough division, but they're better equipped to handle that, the rigors of it, than I think anybody else is.
All right, you're going to have to explain this other one. Von Miller twice breaks his single game sack record in 2022. I think I know where you're going with this, but why don't you kind of spell it out for us?
So you break it once against the Jets and you break it once against the Dolphins, right? And that's kind of what I figured, right? Where, you know, and you know, it's tongue in cheek a little bit, right? But when you have Zach Wilson and Tua Tagovailoa, I think those are two quarterbacks who are running a similar system, you know, has a lot of boot action, a lot of time in the pocket. And then you're facing Micah Hyde and Jordan Poyer. They're going to pin you in the pocket for longer than you need to be. Plus, you're already in your second, you know, you're a second year quarterback. You're still learning processing time. And then Von Miller is just so fast off the edge. You combine all that stuff. I think he's going to be a terror in the backfield. I really think he's going to have a big season this year.
Yeah. I mean, even if he draws the attention, you know, of most offensive lines, which I think we all anticipate happening, I think these young guys on the other side are going to get home and eat enough where they may force opposing offensive lines to play a little bit more honest as the season wears on, and then more opportunities might develop for Miller. And we can't forget the fact, because you mentioned Tua, we can't forget to mention the fact that it's a new offense for Tua too that he's got to learn now. So he could be slow out of the gate. That week three game might be kind of ugly for him with a number one defense that now has Von Miller from last year, the number one defense in the league. I wanted to also cover a guy that is getting a lot of headlines here in Buffalo already, not just from the media, and it doesn't just have the fan base excited, but even veteran players on Buffalo's roster are talking about this kid after 2 weeks of OTAs, James Cook, who you say is going to have more rushing yards than Dalvin Cook. Now, my question to you is, how much of their new offense up in Minnesota is baked into this prediction? Are you expecting Cook to be the bell cow he was, or maybe a little bit more thrown around the yard?
I could imagine Minnesota going more to leaning more towards a committee approach. I mean, I think Mike Zimmer had much more of an old-fashioned mentality to that. He wanted that commanding presence at running back, whereas yeah. I think the new coaching staff is really going to want fresh legs. I think that's, you know, the more obviously the more modern approach, right? You want different styles, different body types to be attacking defenses on different downs. But that said, I mean, I was just really impressed with the Bills running game came a long way last year. And, you know, I think they addressed that after they beat the New England in the playoffs, which was that, you know, they weren't getting the credit. I don't think maybe the media at large was seeing the progress, but we went back and looked at the end of the season. I thought they were running the ball a lot better, blocking it up a lot better. And I think that continues. Plus you just have the dynamic running back. I mean, you watch his tape from college and, you know, not to say that this is a reflection of what they, you know, had on the roster prior, but I just think he adds a different dimension to this offense.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question he does. The thing that I'm wondering is, like, I was thinking about this prediction that you made, James Cook's going to have more rushing yards than Dalvin Cook. I'm wondering if either of them even get to 1,000 because, I mean, we know the Bills offense is going to be throwing a ton. If they run it more than 15 times a game, it's a big deal. They almost never get to 22, let's say. I mean, occasionally they'll get to 20, and sometimes half a dozen of those are Josh running with the ball. So now you divvy it up in the backfield. I don't know if either of those guys get to 1,000 yards, if that's the case, if there's a committee in Minnesota, as it'll probably be here.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I'm kind of looking stylistically at what the Bills might be closer to almost what the Panthers were during some of Cam Newton's best years, right? And I think that you look at the rushing splits there, and Josh isn't going to take as many of the carries away as Cam, but you're right. I mean, it's a committee approach. That said, I think the Bills are going to be up in a lot of these games too. I mean, I think that that's how good of a team they are, that they're going to be able to run the clock out on some of these teams too.
Yeah, I think they only had one victory last year that was by a score or less. So that would make an awful lot of sense going forward into 2022. All right, this one might get some Bills fans a little nervous, but you do have a but in here. Josh Allen will throw a career high number of interceptions, but ... So explain.
But he will also throw a career high in touchdowns. He's going to throw 40 touchdowns. So I think everything's going to be okay. I think you would take that. I think you would take what? 18 interceptions and 40 touchdowns. I think that was close to Matt Stafford's line last year when the Rams won the Super Bowl, if I'm not mistaken. And I think this is a good thing. I don't mind when some quarterbacks, no, maybe not Blake Bortles, right? Post AFC championship, but quarterbacks like Josh, they take a little bit more of a risk. They're less afraid to try to spin the ball into tight places. You know, this is something that Eli Manning did a lot during some of his peak growth years. He had higher interception totals, but that was okay. And I think that that just means he's taking more ownership over the offense. He's displaying confidence in himself. And I think he's going to throw an awful lot of touchdowns this year. So I have all the faith in the world in Josh that he's going to have a good season this year.
Yeah. Moving to the AFC East, the Jets are a team that, and I know a lot hinges on Zach Wilson, obviously, and the reports out of the OTAs aren't glowing right now, but it's, you know, it's June. I'm not freaking out yet. Not that I'm necessarily pulling for the Jets, but the Jets will win at least 6 games. I actually had them pegged at 7-10. I think they could win 7 games this year. And to be honest with you, I'm so down on the Patriots. That might be good enough for third place in this division. What's your call on the Jets? Are you thinking strictly 6, or you think they could go maybe even a game over that?
I think they could go a game over that. I think I would buck against a little bit of the negative. I checked out Zach at OTAs 2 weeks ago, I think, whatever their first OTA practice was, I was there. And, you know, there are not a lot of these wow moments, but I think what he's doing better than he has, you know, and I saw him last year during OTAs too, was that he's getting the ball out on time better, and he's just more accurate in those mid-range throws. He's always going to be phenomenal on the move, right? And kind of boot action stuff and throwing the ball deep. He's always going to be good at that. But he needed to become a more complete quarterback in the offseason, and I think he did that. And the Jets also did another really important thing, which is get some veterans in there, like CJ Uzoma, guys like that, who are just going to help them from a leadership standpoint. That was such a young team last year, and I think that they're going to be a little bit more mature. They're going to be able to handle some of these games this year that they weren't in 2021.
So, I know you probably only saw him for a day or so. There was talk that he's bulked up a little bit, added some muscle to his frame. Did you see that, number one? And then number two, you mentioned the accuracy. What's the general narrative down there with all that they've surrounded him with now? Because you know how New York fans are. They want results yesterday. So what's your general sense on the narrative there now in terms of how much rope Wilson's getting this year?
Yeah, I would say that you have to look at it in two buckets, right? There's the New York narrative, which is, you know, we got them all the weapons. We got them the offensive line. It's got to happen this year. And then I think there's what the team understands and knows, which is this is going to take time. You know, this is going to take another year. And I think that everybody within the building knows that. I think maybe the hope is that ownership is committed to that and realizes that. But, you know, yes, you had a great draft. You brought in prospects, but these guys are still incredibly young. And so I think that the hope is that they give him the time. I think that is really the, because I think he can be a really good player if he's allowed that, those moments to kind of season and develop. But if you're going to try to force the issue this year and say we're either in or out on him, then I think you're going to destroy a good young quarterback, which is something that the Jets have done in the past. And I think this is an opportunity to right those wrongs.
Talking with NFL writer for Sports Illustrated, Connor Orr, and I know I'm putting you on the spot a little bit here, but of these 100 bold predictions, was there one or two that you really liked the most, that you felt the most confident in as soon as you put it down on your laptop?
Well, this is a good Bills connection because it's involving Brian Daboll, but I think Saquon Barkley is going to catch 60 balls this year. And I got criticized for that one a little bit for being too obvious almost. But I think that the Bills, you know, what Brian Daboll is always best at is putting guys in a position to succeed. If you go back to his best games, plays with the Giants, it's always that sprint action stuff out of the backfield with Eli Manning, just dumping him the ball with space, because I think there are problems with him seeing the field and running. You know, I do think that there's a discomfort there. But if you get him the ball with space and just allow him to use his speed and his frame, I think he's going to get out there. And, you know, it might not be a revival season for him, but it'll be good enough. I think he's going to have a nice year this year.
And I wanted to ask you about another piece that you wrote about how it's time for the Browns to speak their truth about quarterback Deshaun Watson. You know, we saw Kevin Stefanski asked about the whole situation all over again when the 23rd civil suit was filed this past week. What more do you think it's incumbent upon the Browns to do as an organization, knowing that members of their own fan base were even opposed to that signing?
I think my argument was pretty simple. It was just, you know, Deshaun at his introductory press conference, you gave him a forum to say that he has never once in his life ever disrespected a woman. And so I think the Browns owe it to us and to their fan base to just either say that they believe him or they don't. And I think that while it doesn't make this easier to stomach or understand, I think it makes it cleaner from an optical standpoint of, okay, we know what direction you guys are coming from. Do you really believe that all 23, now 24 of these people are lying? Or are you betting on our fact, or are you betting on our tendency as a society to forget about things after a while? And I think, you know, I'm curious which one of those their strategy was. I have a feeling I know which one it is, but yeah, when you're a team that makes a move like that, I would like you, and I think you owe it to the public to come out and say that.
Yeah. It's almost as if, and I probably shouldn't assume this, but you get the sense that they're banking on, as soon as we start winning games, people will forget and stop complaining about, you know, the optics surrounding Deshaun Watson and the decision to overlook 23 civil suits filed against him. I think they're banking on them having success on the field, and that's just going to melt everything else away. I don't know if you feel similarly, but
I think that is probably a large portion of the plan, right? I mean, yeah, if you go back and you watch the press conference, what Andrew Berry said over and over again was it was a process to get comfortable with Deshaun. And he never said it was a process to prove his innocence. It was a process of, we're getting comfortable with the idea, right? Yeah. And comfortable with the idea means if we're 11-6 next year, then I think that, you know, a lot of people will get comfortable too, which is a tough pill to swallow societally right now. But, you know, I think that's kind of where we're at.
Yeah. The whole thing just makes me want to take a shower. Last one for you, so we can finish on a little bit better note. Frank Gore, you wrote about him recently and how his work ethic is going to lead him into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I think there's only one running back that's gotten over 12,000 yards who is not in the Hall of Fame, and that's Ricky Waters. Frank's a shoo-in with 16,000. First of all, how cool is it? The guy plays for 16 years and has exactly 16,000 rushing yards. I don't know what it is about the number. I just think that's the coolest thing. And he's 15 yards shy of 20,000 total yards from scrimmage in his career. Just a remarkable career that defied any and all logic after a couple of ACL injuries in college. But, I mean, this guy, if his longevity isn't respected enough, maybe he's not first ballot. But, man, I'd be hard-pressed to say that he isn't at least first ballot consideration. Because if you can play that long and be that productive at that position, I mean, doesn't that cement you? He should be first ballot, I think.
Yeah, and this isn't a knock on Tom Brady, but we just – deify his longevity, but Frank Gore did it for almost as long at a position that's 30 times as violent. And he didn't have, you know, he didn't go to the Buccaneers, right? He didn't go to an all-star roster. The Bills were that 2019 year was his last winning season. He was taking carries for some really bad football teams. I mean, you know, kind of the 500 Colts teams that just trying to get by, and you know, the Jets team in 2020, right. That wasn't pretty, but that was just pure love of football. And I think that we've gotten away from celebrating that in guys. And Frank just, he wasn't in it to do anything else, but just showcase how much he loved the game and how much he loved to play. And I think that means a lot to a lot of us as fans.
Yeah. I mean, I remember the year he was with the Bills, we're down in Spartanburg, South Carolina, doing joint practices with the Panthers. I go to the hotel gym at like 6:30 just to try to get 20 minutes in, you know, before breakfast or whatever. Frank Gore is in there in one of those sweat jackets, and I mean, it's just rolling off him. I'm like, this guy's got practice in like 3 hours. What the heck? And he's 36. Like, what the hell is going on here? I was just like, this guy's just a different breed of cat, man. He's unbelievable.
Really incredible. I mean, was doing two-a-days. I think he told Sports Illustrated this past year that it was the first double workout that he had missed in like 21 years.
Wow.
Something like that. Wow. Like, think about that. That's crazy.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Well, listen, Connor, thanks for giving us some time today. I'm sure we'll catch up with you later in the offseason. And if you want to check it out, it's his 100 Bold Predictions at SI.com. Thanks very much, Connor. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
All right, that's Connor Orr joining us, NFL writer for Sports Illustrated. And I do have to say, like, the Frank Gore thing, I think he had 9 1,000-yard rushing seasons in his 16-year career. As I mentioned, he finished with exactly 16,000 yards in his 16 NFL seasons, rushing yards I'm talking about. And I don't think people realize this, but he is third on the all-time rushing list, behind Emmitt Smith and Walter Payton. So, hello? I think he's a shoo-in. And I think he's got a very good chance to be a first ballot guy, quite frankly. Some may argue that and whether it's deserved. And as you heard Connor mention, he didn't play on a ton of great football teams. He played on some playoff caliber football teams. But man, I mean, you knew what the guy was bringing every single week. And if you hear Devin Singletary talk about him, he talks about him in glowing terms, because Singletary was a rookie the year Frank was here, and he credits a lot of the lessons he learned in how to be a true professional from Frank. And that's not to say that Devin didn't have a work ethic that was good enough to be a success in this league to begin with, but I think a lot of the little nuances of what Frank did to be a true pro only benefited Devin Singletary and where he's at now. So just something else to kind of chalk up to Frank. You know, you hear all the time about all of these these successful head coaches in the league and their coaching trees, so to speak. Andy Reid, obviously, with all the different guys in the league that have been, you know, branched off of his tree, whether it's Sean McDermott or John Harbaugh. You know, you can run down the list, even Leslie Frazier. So Frank Gore and the number of guys that he's mentored in this league, it's probably as big as like the coaching tree of Andy Reid or Mike Shanahan or Bill Walsh, because he's played so long and he mentored so many guys. And if you talk to any young player in the league that played behind Frank Gore on the depth chart, the first thing they'll tell you is if you had a question, he was more than happy to give you an answer. So not just an uncommonly productive player for as long as he was at the most punishing position in the game, but a good dude too when it came to paying it forward, which, you know, more often than not, most veteran players do in this league, even though it is cutthroat in terms of competition. A lot of those established guys do know how to pay it forward to the younger players. So you don't only tip your hat to Frank Gore for what he accomplished in terms of his career production, but in terms of the guy he was and paying it forward to the next generation of players. We have to take a break here, but when we come back, we crack open the OBL Fan Friday mailbag. So if you have any questions and you didn't send it in at One Bills Live on the tweet sheet, you can call, give us a call at 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550. Got an open line for you there. Let's talk some Bills football or some NFL at large next here on One Bills Live, presented by Kaleida Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, welcome back. It is that time, OBL Friday fan mailbag time. Any questions that you might have, fire them off right now. You can give us a call. Open lines for you at 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550. Any question about the Bills or the NFL at large, fire them off. Be happy to answer for you. We've been collecting some on Twitter, at OneBillsLive, which is another place you can send your questions if you have them. And we lead off with Scott, who said, what's your daily routine for the show? Production meetings before, have show, and then more meetings after. I'm unfamiliar with the process involved in putting on a live talk show that airs on TV and radio. I think it would be hard work, but you guys make it look easy. Go Bills. Well, thanks, Scott. I appreciate that. I would say, first and foremost, we do discuss things the morning of. It's funny because you certainly want to be prepared. You know, Steve and I are usually researching the latest news going on around the league. Obviously, we've got our ear to the ground here at One Bills Drive as far as what's going on here. And then we'll try to develop certain show topics with our producer, Jay Harris. We also get support from the control room staff, you know, sending us news from around the league, social media people, that kind of stuff. So we'll kind of collect. It's a collection effort first. And then we whittle the list down to the things we want to focus on through the course of the show that we think you guys will find interesting, and then we take it from there. As far as post-production after the show, sometimes we'll rehash a few things based on how we thought it went, but more often than not, once a show is put to bed, we're on to the next. And so sometimes if there is breaking news that happened during the show or even after the show, sometimes we'll have a text string going on at night to kind of prep for the next day with some thoughts and ideas there. But sometime, more often than not, after we do that day's show, we'll put that to bed. Maybe we'll tie up some loose ends in our office after, but it's really pretty much on to the next after that. And that's kind of, I think that's kind of how we do it. I will say this, a lot of times I'll have something that I want to tell Steve when I come into the office, but then I think better of it. I say, you know what? I'm not going to tell him till we're on the air, because more often than not, I can get a more organic response out of Steve and a more natural response because he's hearing it for the first time. If I tell him at 9:30 in the morning when we're here, when we come on at 1, I'm not going to get the same response or comment from him that I would live on the show. And I think it's a more natural answer from Steve, and very often it's a more entertaining answer for you listening to the show. So I kind of make a habit of doing that. So even while we'll conceptualize and talk about the direction the show is going to go, we don't really talk too much about detail. He does his research at his desk over here. I'll do mine over here. We'll clue each other in on some of the things we're talking or seeing or looking at, but we won't kind of kibitz back and forth about it because we try to save that for the show for a more organic conversation. So hopefully that works for you guys. Tammy asks on the fan mailbag, wouldn't it be so great if Fitzy could retire a Buffalo Bill? He loved us when it wasn't cool to be on the Bills. It would mean so much to him and to us too. Do you think they can make this happen? I would say this. There's already talks that, you know, Fitz is going to be on a pregame show for Amazon's streaming of NFL games this season on Thursdays. That could conceivably leave some weekends open for him. So whether he's here leading the charge in a pregame or coming here to sign a one-day contract to retire a Buffalo Bill, I don't know. After watching Fitz basically text message almost all of his teammates that he's had over the last 17 years with a graphic that had all of their names listed, I wonder if he would be comfortable doing that. What I mean, would he be comfortable retiring as a Buffalo Bill, signing a one-day contract here? Because I wonder if he would feel he would be, not disrespecting is too strong a word, but making light of his time with the eight other teams for which he played, including the Rams, who drafted him. I'm not going to try to crawl into Fitz's head to think that would be an issue for him. I'd definitely be in favor of having him come back, sign a one-day contract. I think that'd be a cool deal. I don't think it would be an issue. I'd be all in favor of that, and I could see Fitz saying yes to that if he's asked. But I'd definitely love to see him here before the start of a big game. Heck, I'd bring him back for the Patriots game and tell him to wave the flag around shirtless. That's what I would do. See if he'd be up for that. He certainly has enough chest hair to stay warm, so I'm not worried about that, especially if he's doing it the playoff game last winter in January, which is the coldest game we've had here in quite a while. So, yeah, I'm on board, Tammy. I'm all in favor of it, and I wouldn't rule it out. I think there's a chance that could happen. If not this season, certainly some season in the future for sure. So that would definitely be cool. Good idea. Nick from the mailbag asks, is there any possibility that Cook, Singletary, Johnson, and Moss all make the team this year? If someone does have to be cut, who do you think it'll be? I think Johnson fits our offensive scheme better than Moss, but Moss stands out by being the only real power option we have. Nick, I think you've kind of nailed this down pretty effectively on your own. Is there a possibility all four are on the roster? I think it's tough only because technically Tywan Jones is a running back, and unless he's lost two steps, he's going to be on this team because of his special teams prowess. That's why they keep re-signing him to one-year contracts. Even when he left to go play for Houston, they signed him the very next year when he was a free agent again and brought him back. Because of that, you know, you technically have a running back already on special teams, then you're probably carrying three more. And don't forget about the dual position nature of Reggie Gilliam, who I also think is going to be on this roster because of the different roles he can play within the scope of your offense, most notably fullback, if in fact you feel you need one. And I would tend to lean toward Gilliam being on the roster, and serving in a role similar to the one he played last year. So you roll all that together, I don't think all four of those guys make this roster. So it then becomes a question of, do you believe that Moss stands out as a true power runner and you don't feel you have anybody else that can do that? Because I think the biggest adversary working against Zach Moss is not Duke Johnson. It might be Reggie Gilliam. Because if you need a power guy, if you believe Reggie Gilliam can do that, well, then I think that hurts Zach Moss' case even more. And look, I'm going to be the first guy to tell you, I think Moss is a good player. I was genuinely excited when they drafted him because I thought he had a lot of that Bills DNA that they look for. And I don't think we should dismiss the fact that Brandon Bean made a point of saying on our show and in other places when he made public comments that Zach Moss's ankle that he broke in the playoff game against Indy in the 2020 season in the playoffs still wasn't right last year and really hindered his cutting ability last season. So I'm very interested to see a better version of Zach Moss this year. And I don't think he's a guy who's going to pop to the naked eye or to fans watching at training camp until they have padded practices because he has a physical game. And I think he is somewhat underrated as a receiver. Now, look, is he Duke Johnson as a receiver? Is he James Cook as a receiver? Probably not. But he's more than capable as a pass catcher. So I think it's going to be a very interesting decision for this coaching staff to make. And here's the other thing. Because personally, I think Cook and Singletary are locks for the roster. Those guys are locks. And then Moss and Johnson, it's a little more iffy. And so if James Cook is lighting the world on fire in the spring and when we get to training camp and when we get to the preseason, the question becomes, is Cook so good that there's no way Duke Johnson, whose skill set is most closely related to Cook, is Cook so good there's no way Duke Johnson is getting on the field and he's just going to be inactive every week? So does that mean you take Moss instead? because he offers maybe some different things to that of Cook? Or do you say what Cook does in this offense is so important, we need a backup who can do similar things, and yes, we keep Duke Johnson because of that fact, and then does Moss become the victim? That's a decision I can't definitively say I know what the Bills are going to do there. A lot has to happen between now and the end of August, obviously, and then it becomes a true preference for what Ken Dorsey and Sean McDermott feel this offense needs from a skill set perspective going forward. So that's where the rub is. And I wish I could give you a definitive answer, but right now I don't think we can. So I hope that spells out at least the good dilemma that the Bills coaching staff is going to have come late August in terms of figuring out that running back position. Tim from the OBL mailbag asks, what do you make of the Tavon Austin signing, a sign the Bills are not happy with the returners? As a wide receiver, he doesn't appear different than McKenzie or Stevenson. I kind of addressed this at the top of the show, but I'll reiterate some of it. I think there are three things at play here. Number one, Coach McDermott loves to prompt guys to give their level best, even in June. How do you do that? You do it by adding competition to the fray. And Tavon Austin is unquestionably that. I will agree with you, Tim, that he is similar in skill set, probably most to Isaiah McKenzie, lesser so Stevenson, because Tavon Austin has got more shake and wiggle to his game than Speedy Stevenson has. Stevenson is fast, but in a straight line variety. He's not going to shake anybody out of his shoes. He's just going to blow by people. Tavon Austin and Isaiah McKenzie can shake people, with jitterbug style. So because of that, I would say he's more closely matched to the skill set of McKenzie than he is Stevenson. And I will say this, in addition to Coach McDermott and his coaching staff's desire to churn the roster at the bottom to spark greater motivation on the part of those players on the back half of the roster, I think what also could be at work here is a peek into what Isaiah McKenzie's role could be. And I don't know this. This is a hypothesis. Isaiah McKenzie, in every opportunity he's been given to spot start in this offense, has come through in sparkling fashion. Whether you want to talk about the season finale against the Dolphins in 2020, the 56-26 game where he had three touchdowns, or you want to talk about week 15 last year against the Patriots when he had 11 catches for 125 yards and a touchdown in a crucial game where they were shorthanded on offense, he's earned the right to have a larger role in this offense. The question is Ken Dorsey going to give it to him, and is Sean McDermott going to sign off on it? Because if you give him a bigger role on offense, it stands to reason that you have to curtail his role on special teams as a return man. So if you're going to do that, do the Bills want to rely solely on a second-year player who got very little time in the special teams portion of the game at the very tail end of the season in Speedy Stevenson, or do you want a more proven player to serve as competition for Stevenson in the return game? So knowing the way this team has operated over the years, while they can be encouraged and even excited about a young prospect who has a skill set like Speedy Stevenson, Brandon Bean, the personnel department, and the coaching staff, more often than not, like to have a veteran option to turn to. And I think Tavon Austin is that veteran option, not only to serve as competition for Speedy Stevenson, but maybe to serve as injury insurance for a guy like Isaiah McKenzie. So that's where I kind of come down on the Tavon Austin signing. Andrew asks in the OBL Fan Friday mailbag, still feel like we need another safety. Who would you like to see the Bills pick up for that position? My answer is no one. And this is why. The Bills, and if you really don't pay attention to the back end of the roster, the Bills, for the better part of the last 3 years, have been very quietly stockpiling young safeties. They did it with sixth-round pick Jaquan Johnson 3 years ago. They did it with DeMar Hamlin, a sixth-round pick last year. And 2 years ago, they did it in the undrafted free agent signings, signing undrafted free agent rookie Josh Thomas out of Appalachian State in 2020. All three of those players are still on the roster. So the opportunities for them, admittedly, have been few and far between because Poyer and Micah Hyde don't miss games. They've been remarkably healthy. I think Poyer missed one game last year and a game the year before that, and I think Hyde missed a game in 2020. So those two guys have been remarkably durable, remarkably productive. They are the linchpins of the back end of this defense. So the opportunities for guys to get on the field, Jaquan Johnson, DeMar Hamlin, Josh Thomas, who's been on the practice squad the last 2 years, have been very limited. If you bring in another veteran safety, you're saying two things. One, we want another veteran to serve as insurance in case Poyer and Hyde get healthy. And number two, you're saying with all this grooming you've done and all the tutelage that Jaquan Johnson, DeMar Hamlin, and Josh Thomas have gotten working at the elbow of Micah Hyde and Jordan Poyer every day for the better part of the last 1, 2, or 3 years in the same defensive system, you're basically saying you don't trust those guys to capably step in if Jordan Poyer and or Micah Hyde can't go on a given Sunday. And I don't think that's the way Sean McDermott runs his football team. If you're going to put the time in and you're going to work hard, improve yourself as a player, so when the time does come to step in and play, that you're ready, well then, why are you asking those young guys to do that? If you're just going to sign a veteran off the street to come in cold with half the knowledge of this defensive system and plug them in instead of one of those guys. And we saw that last year. Week 4 against the Texans, it's a blowout, it's a shutout, it winds up being 40-0. They pull some of their starters early. Jaquan Johnson's on the field, he gets a pick at the end of the game. That reinforces the level of trust that this coaching staff is going to have in those young guys if and when it comes time to call their number and put them in the lineup in a given week where, God forbid, Jordan Poyer or Micah Hyde are injured and can't play. So there's been a lot of grooming the last couple of years at the safety position, you know, pretty much in secret behind Poyer and Hyde because they haven't played. But you got those guys playing, they'll be ready if their number has to be called. So that's where I come down on that. That's the OBL Fan Friday mailbag. If I have a chance to get a couple more on the other side of this break, I will do that. Other than that, we'll catch up with you in a second here on One Bills Live. Stay tuned. All right, welcome back. One Bills Live. Just about wrapping it up here for the weekend. And one more from the OBL Fan Friday mailbag. Daniel asked, hi, Chris, do you know if Justin Zimmer is still on the team? I like the way he played for us. Thanks, go Bills. He is not on the roster. He unfortunately suffered an ACL knee injury last season, was not yet healthy, I believe, to pass a physical. And so with him not healthy enough to play, using a roster spot for him probably just didn't make sense at the time. The team was just as happy with him as well, with the way he played for this team, not only last year, but the season before. And so I think if they had their druthers, a healthy Justin Zimmer would be on this roster right now. But it's the injury that I think compromised those plans. Want to remind you that our Bills by the Numbers podcast with myself and Steve is up now. The latest episode is out. It deals with the best deep ball passers in the league in 2021. Take a guess who's at the top of the list. We dive into the numbers on that, and we also have our one burning question. You never want to miss Steve playing the numbers game. It's the best thing you'll ever listen to. Bills by the Numbers. We'll see you on Monday at 1.